1976, I published in Early American Literature an article on the very subject that we are dealing with this morning. It was called British Views of the American Revolution, A Conflict Over Rights of Sovereignty. My sources were the usual ones from 18th century studies. I originally approached it in terms of Edmund Burke's response to the American Revolution, but I soon realized that there was quite a range of other views toward the revolution, and the whole article grew out of that awareness. Later on, I was aware that I'd only used the most conventional sources for Burke's studies on the American Revolution, and when I went back and reread some of the lesser-known works, I came to a conclusion that it needed to be revised, and so I rewrote my article, and the second version was published in a book called The Enduring Edmund Burke, edited by Ian Crow, and it also includes the whole question of the after effects of the American Revolution, the Second Empire of the British system. Now, from 1761 to around 1783, British views toward the American Revolution varied very considerably, fluctuated wildly. There was no monolithic view of the revolution among Tories or Whigs or 18th century Commonwealth men, or even among the general public, the English public at large, because they really did not understand what the issue was. Conflicting rights of sovereignty between the British Parliament and the individual colonies, and particularly the state the colonial legislatures themselves. Perhaps no one understood the real issues that were emerging better than Francis Bernard, the last royal governor of Massachusetts Bay, from 1760 to around 1769. I would like to read a paragraph that he wrote on this occasion, which I think really puts a frame of reference around the entire problem confronting the American colonies in England. This is what Bernard said. "The question is whether America shall or shall not be subject to the legislative body of Great Britain. All the political evils in America rise from the want of ascertaining the relationship between Great Britain and her colonies. Hence it is that in America, the relations as formed in Britain and America, every very repugnant and conflicting views are arrived at out of misunderstanding. In Britain, the American government are considered as corporates embodied by bylaws. That is, the colonial assemblies that were established by charter were considered by the British as bylaws, only existing during the pleasure of Parliament itself, and without any genuine power over the internal affairs of each colony. In America, these colonial charters and legislative bodies were considered as separate government institutions, which should not be interfered with by the British Parliament. And so the conflict was really one of American sovereignty versus British sovereignty, as he saw it. Historically, the whole matter, of course, was finally settled by the growing conflicts that led to military conflicts at Lexington and Concord, and ultimately to the Revolutionary War. The sovereign rights of the Americans were, first of all, brought to a head by certain acts, the Grenville Ministry in particular, through the Stamp Act, provoked the issue of sovereignty in a way that had never been done before. And this led finally to three distinct points of view in Britain toward the American colonies. There were those who, first of all, wished to see the Americans completely free from England. They felt it was to the benefit of England, much more so than even to the colonies. And then there were others who insisted that the second point of view, that the colonies should submit to the English Parliament in all things where sovereignty was concerned, not only in external matters, but internal affairs such as taxation and regulation of trade. And finally, there was a third view, which is largely held by Edmund Burke and the Rockingham Whigs, that there should be a conciliation between the colonies and Britain to settle these issues peacefully so that they would not come to a point where a revolution as such would take place. Now, Burke himself never regarded the phrase the American Revolution as a very accurate way of describing what happened. He never used the term. He always referred to the war, the American War, and he regarded it as, first of all, a conflict that emerged partly because of conflicts of sovereignty, but eventually over psychological impasses that made it impossible for them to reconcile each other. And these conflicts finally ended up in a military form that determined the whole issue. There were quite a few Englishmen who felt that America should have its independence immediately. This was at least a year and a half before Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. We often think in American history that Jefferson was the initiator of the concept of independence, but there's ample evidence that he had many predecessors in England who insisted that on abstract grounds of rights of sovereignty, that the colonies should go their own way. Francis Hutchinson, who was a professor of moral philosophy at Glasgow University, had put forth a theory that colonies as such, when they reach a certain point of self-development, are no longer tied or legally bound to adhere to the mother country that founded them, and should, in effect, evolve into separate independent institutions. But his views were pretty much in a minority. The second point of view that was put forth was pretty largely summarized by Samuel Johnson, who became, in effect, the official spokesman for the king and a majority of the English public, who felt that the colonies must submit unconditionally to the laws passed, statutes passed by the House of Commons and submitted to the king and approved thereof. In several very well-known essays, Johnson submitted his case, and it's a very strong case in terms of legal foundations, that since the colonies were founded under English guidance, they accepted English protection from both the French in the north and the Spanish to the south, that their dependence was entirely upon England, that therefore England should, in effect, rule the colonies. Now this, of course, we ignore the fact that a great many changes had occurred within the colonial assemblies over a period of time, and by the 1760s, these changes had come to a head pretty largely so that they had to be resolved one way or another. The third view of British views toward the American Revolution was that espoused by Edmund Burke and the Rockingham Whigs. Burke himself believed that the principle of sovereignty by the British Parliament was absolute, but that moral prudence dictated that they should not apply every power that they had merely because they had it. that they had to combine this with circumstances that existed in the colonies, the circumstance being that many of the colonists who had migrated to America were imbued with the spirit of freedom. As he pointed out, for example, in his speech on conciliation, that in New England, that spirit was very largely centered in the religious dissent of the Calvinists who settled there, the congregational interests that had come to dominate that whole northeast section of the colonial empire. And in the southern states, even the existence of slavery, Burke pointed out, was a factor in favor of freedom on the part of those who were not slaves, who could appreciate, by contrast, between the condition of the slaves and their own more favorable condition, the very great importance of freedom. He also pointed out that more copies of the institutes concerning English common law were published and read in America than even in England. And this in itself gave a kind of legal sanction to the advent of liberty among the colonies that had to be taken into account. So the Burke really felt that conciliation was the crucial principle. His speech on conciliation, of course, the very title of it indicates the basic policy which the Rockingham Whigs followed. The Rockingham Whigs were instrumental in repealing the most obnoxious laws that had been passed by their predecessor, particularly the Stamp Act. And for a year after that, there was, in effect, great peace and a sense of security among the colonists. But then the insistence on the part of certain members of the House of Commons that sovereignty must be ascertained and insisted upon much more rigorously. And so the Townsend Acts were followed by the repeal of the Stamp Act. And of course, one of these included the result in the Boston Tea Party, which again precipitated another crisis quite early. The conflict really comes down finally to a question of moral prudence. And Burke himself said that prudence is the first of political virtues, and that all other virtues depend upon that. An abstract notion of ideological rights is fatal if you follow it to its logical conclusion. And he did not believe, for example, as so many of the dissenting sects did, in appealing to abstract rights of liberty without reference to circumstances and historical developments, that this was not the grounds on which the American conflict was to be resolved. And that is one reason why, for example, Burke had a rather favorable view toward the American Revolution and a very unfavorable view toward the French Revolution. He believed that the American Revolution was not based upon an ideological set of abstract principles. There have been a great many histories written about America, about the colonies, which take that for granted. The ideological basis of the American Revolution is certainly one of the important scholarly interpretations of the Revolution even to this day. Burke himself approached the American problem in constitutional terms. Probably no one in England was better rooted in law than Edmund Burke. His legal erudition was incredible. He absorbed the whole system of law from the Justinian Code of ancient Roman times, English common law. He had reviewed all the law books that came out in England during his own time, so that he was a kind of walking dictionary of legal knowledge. But unlike Samuel Johnson, he did not apply that across the board to the colonies themselves. The colonies themselves had that kind of knowledge, and they were, in effect, they gave the constitutional basis for the conflict. Burke regarded the American Revolution, American colonies, as standing on the defensive against England in the conflict that gradually emerged. Whereas on the king and his ministers, on the other hand, regarded the colonies with great suspicion. They felt that the colonists a priori were beginning to think of independence without any reference to taxation or regulation or anything else. In other words, an abstract ideological concept. And Burke denied that that was so. And that, of course, is one of the contrasts between the American Revolution and the French Revolution. In a sense, it's a very unfortunate thing that the word revolution is applied to both events, because I think it obscures the distinction between an ideological approach to human affairs and a constitutional approach to human affairs, as Burke had in the second instance. Many people simply take the terms revolution and they assume across the board that a revolution is a revolution, whether it happened in America or in France. If we are to compare revolutions, say, compare the American Revolution and the French Revolution, as so often has been done, I think that that automatically creates problems that makes us make connections that often do not exist. If I were to compare the French Revolution with any revolution, it would have to be with the Russian Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 and not with the American Revolution. Lenin himself said as much, that he was modeling the Russian Revolution on the French Revolution, but he was going to carry it simply much farther than they had done in France. And I think a good deal of one of the reasons why Burke has, in his interpretation of the revolution, has continued to command respect is that he made these distinctions between constitution and ideology. Prudence was his great principle, and it's an interesting thing that among the Victorian commentators on Burke's politics, of which Lord John Morley was the chief commentator, they misunderstood what he meant by prudence. They recognized that he said this was the first of political virtues, but they proceeded to understand it in intellectual terms, in utilitarian and pragmatic terms, not as a moral precept putting a check upon the will of those who exercise power in the state. And that Morley was so instrumental in this respect, he wrote two books on Burke, and he was also given the job of writing the Encyclopedia Britannica article on Burke, which held sway in many American and British quarters as almost the official interpretation of what might be said about Burke. In his two books and article, he never once mentioned moral natural law. And I think this indicates the extent to which the Victorian commentators on Burke were led entirely by the prevailing philosophy of utilitarianism and pragmatism, and also of scientific positivism, to interpret Burke in manners that did not correspond with his own convictions. Another factor that gave Burke some insights into the American situation was that for the 10 years before Lexington and Concord, he had been appointed the agent in Parliament for the colony of New York. And he was in close correspondence with Schuyler and Livingston, Delancey and other people in the state legislature in Albany. And so he was quite aware of what the discontents amounted to and was able to put his finger on exactly what was gelling in the colonies themselves. We all know, for example, that Burke's views on conciliation were rejected, for example, by Sir Lewis Namier, one of the outstanding sociological critics of the American Revolution. Namier had no use for anything that even had the slightest hint of rebellion against the established authority of the state. He denied, for example, that there was a kind of a secret cabinet which reported to the king himself on events in America, and that all of the charges of tyranny made by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence had no foundation whatsoever. George III was not a tyrant, although he was pictured as such by Jefferson in the justification of that event. In effect, the American Revolution destroyed the first British Empire in America. They learned a very severe lesson from that, and the Second Empire really was a shift in gears from America to the mostly to the Orient. And it's an interesting point to note that the British no longer wished to colonize these places in the Orient, but simply to establish trading posts for commerce and so on. The East India Company became the crucial agent in the Second Imperial development after the American Revolution had brought the First Empire pretty largely to a close, except, of course, in Canada, where the British continued to maintain their interest in terms of colonies and land rather than simply trade. The British Empire concept is, of course, very crucial to any interpretation of the British views toward the American Revolution, and that continued to be so right down to very recent times. Peter Marshall, one of the outstanding Burke scholars, a great authority on Burke in India, has written two, he edited the two volumes on the collected works of Burke that deal with India. He wrote an article called The British Empire and the American Revolution, in which he contrasted very strongly the differences between the manner in which the British handled the American situation and how they shifted gears and, in effect, learned a good deal from the first American Revolution so that they did no longer apply some of the same abstract ideological concepts to the British Empire in the East. When Cornwallis surrendered and news came to London that his entire army was lost, the Parliament recognized that the colonies, the American colonies, were lost to England. At the very first meeting of the Commons after that, Burke reminded his colleagues in the House of Commons why they had done what they did. They had simply appealed to abstract ideological rights, constitutional rights of sovereignty, which they held undoubtedly legally. As he said so beautifully in the speech on conciliation, by pushing that argument as far as they did, they in effect won an argument and lost an empire. And that was the folly of an ideological approach to social and political matters. Now, Burke himself probably understood the constitutional basis of the American rebellion against England. The ordinary person doesn't deal in theory. He knows when something has been done by government that injures him in his personal rights, his freedom, his property, or any other kind of civil law that comes under constitutional allowances. It's a curious thing about Burke that although he was so imbued with constitutional awareness in defending the rights of the Americans against the what he considered the imprudent and somewhat unconstitutional actions of the British government, once the Americans received their independence, curiously enough, Burke had almost nothing to say about the American Constitution that emerged after the Articles of Confederation. And that has puzzled a great many scholars as to why he didn't comment on the American Constitution after the American Revolution had given the colonies their freedom. I think the answer to that may be that he believed that constitutions grow through a long historical process. They are not something simply made on paper through rational reasoning. And to a certain extent, the American Constitution did, in fact, have to deal with that process, but they made very good use of their English inheritance. And, of course, they followed a basic structure of government between king, lords, and commons in terms of a republican form rather than a monarchical form of government. But the president had some of the same executive powers as a king, and of course we had both the House of Commons through our elected representatives and a House of Lords in terms of a Senate. He reminded the French revolutionists when they wanted to merge everything into a unicameral assembly that they had forgotten to constitute a Senate, so that there was no check, no balance of any power that could be construed on the part of a unified legislative assembly. It was a Rousseauistic rather than a constitutional concept of government that they pretty largely followed, although Rousseau himself had said that such a unicameral form of government could not endure on a large scale. It was only fitting on small city-states such as a Swiss canton rather than on an area as vast as the 13 colonies, the whole colonial and continental area of the American Republic along the Atlantic. It's an interesting thing to keep in mind, too, that whereas the American colonists were mostly English, and they rebelled against England, that in Canada, where in Quebec in particular, of course, the entire population was French, and yet the French stood loyally with the English in the War of 1812. They did not see it as an attempt to, an opportunity to merge themselves with the Americans. That was because the English government had begun to make the kinds of concessions to the French Canadians that they had refused to do to the very American colonies who had rebelled. The whole issue, of course, finally came down pragmatically to whether or not the British government was to apply its power with restraint using the common law as a guide in exercising moral prudence in its jurisdiction over the colonies. Burke believed that the colonists were on the defensive against the British in this war, and that the ideological approach was fatal to any order or civil liberty that might be maintained in America. And that was his final view of the American Revolution. Thank you.